more often than not, weather was the controlling factor here. Mm-hmm. And if the weather was good, he would say, yes, there will be operations tonight, and then he would go down his priority list of targets, which had been agreed to, I suppose, really at the big four conferences and so forth as to what that sort of priority was. And it certainly came to him from the Air Ministry. And then he would pick a target, and then that would then go out on the net in code to the groups. So the groups knew, number one, there would be operations that night. No, I'm sorry, the target did not go out immediately. The groups were told that there would be operations that night. Then a little later, they would be given the target. For pure security reasons, yep. They would actually hold the target back as long as possible. But they would be given the bomb loads, whether it would be all HE or whether it would be all incendiary or mixed loads, that sort of thing, so that at least the bombing up, at least the armorers in the dumps could begin to get the bombs onto the trolleys and get the fuses onto them and so forth. So then as soon as they knew what the bomb load per airplane was to be, which was a factor of the fuel load as well, then they'd just run the trolleys right out to the aircraft and then just hoist them up into position. Yeah. They wouldn't know at that time how many bombs were actually going to go on each airplane. Yeah. But they had to get them onto the trolleys, out of the dump, and as I say, get them fused and get the cans of incendiaries put together. There was a lot of work that had to be done before they even looked at an airplane.
Another small question, this from a social point of view. You're now living in a castle, or at least operating out of a castle.
Yes.
Did you live in it? Are you
no.
Are you back
no,
in
we
quarters?
Had no, no, we had Nissen huts on the grounds. Even the mess was a Nissen hut. No, the whole of the building was taken over for operations. Of course, big communications center, which was in the basement. Mm-hmm. Then there had to be the engineering sections. There had to be the photographic section for developing photographs. Libraries, the operational research people, the training staff, the personnel staff, the op staff. No, the castle was completely taken over. No eating facilities or anything like that. The kitchens, I forget what the kitchens were. I think the kitchens became part of the communications center. And the ops room. And, of course, big ops room staff, because you're working 24 hours a day, and so you have to have staff in the ops room. Any job that was required 24 hours, then there were staff provided on a 24-hour basis. Yeah. But the Air One, the Air One, the SASO, and the AOC, of course, that was it. You were just there, and you were on call literally 24 hours a day, and that was it.
Yeah.
When the Air One had done his briefing and the AOC had added his comments, there was nothing else you could do then, unless there was a last-minute panic of some kind or a change of target. That didn't happen all that often. Then you sat, and then the word would come in from all the bases. The names would begin to go up on the blackboards in the ops room, and one wall of the ops room, the whole length, was nothing but squadrons and just blackboards. And the staff would then write the airplane number, the call sign, the name of the captain. What the hell else would there be? I guess that would be about it. Oh, yes, takeoff time, landing time. Mm-hmm. And then they would all go up, and then we'd go away. There wasn't much else we could do until takeoff time, and then the AOC and I would always go back to the option for takeoff. If we had not gone out to one of the bases, quite frequently we would go out to a base and be there in time for the briefing at the base.
Yeah.
But some of the bases were about 2 or 3 hours away, so there was no hope. In any case, then we would vote for the takeoff and be there just as the troops would drive around the dispersal area and see the boys before they actually climbed into the airplanes and away they went.
You wouldn't have your own little aircraft for that?
No, because there was no airfield nearby. Linton was the nearest airfield, and by the time you'd driven to Linton, you could almost drive to one of the northern bases. And with weather, we never knew. And with a light airplane, no way. And there were no nav aids. It was just not worth it to start puttering around at nighttime in small airplanes. It was bad enough in daylight.
That I can well imagine.
Then, of course, you'd go to bed. And then get up in time for the return. And, of course, the return was always the most trying period. I'm sorry. As each airplane took off, going back to takeoff, as each airplane took off, it was reported into the group ops room. Mm-hmm. And the takeoff time would go up on the board. And what we were then interested in at group was, did all the airplanes get off? Did we meet our our quota of airplanes. And there were times when you run into some kind of servicing problem and you'd have in the squadron perhaps two airplanes not take off. Then they'd be the hot lines would go like crazy. Is he going to get off? Because there's a cutoff. By this time, the raids were terribly concentrated. Whereas before, a raid might take 3 hours, we're now talking in terms of a large number of airplanes, hundreds of airplanes going across a target in 25, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now, if the airplane couldn't get off in time to get into that stream, he didn't go, because he would be a straggler, just a sitting duck, either on the way in or on the way out from the target. So there was a cutoff point when no airplane could go. If he couldn't get off by that time, then it was a no-go. And what we were always worried about was just how many airplanes did not make it, because this was an important operational factor. And, of course, the odd time when we did have every airplane took off was almost a cause for celebration. When you had 300 airplanes on the board and 300 took off, that really was, with no unserviceability of any kind, that really was a great, great, great show. Well, on the return, this was, as I say, was the most trying time, and we'd go down to the ops room, the AOC and myself, and we'd sit there, and waiting for the reverse action to take place. As an airplane landed, the time of landing would go up on the board. And, of course, any outstanding airplanes, we'd sit there and sit there waiting, hoping that word would come in from one of the other groups that he'd been in trouble and had landed just at any place, just to get on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then finally, after about an hour and a half of that, which was normally long enough for any stragglers or strays to turn up, we would then sit and look at the board and see just how many airplanes we had lost on that particular raid. And that was always a terrible time. I remember the one time, I think maybe I have already made reference to this a little earlier on, but I think I said I'd come back to it. When I was talking about the caliber of the crews that we were getting and how we were getting a lot of people coming over into Pathfinders who had been in training command here in Canada. Mm-hmm. And we had two very keen types who were both station commanders here in Canada as group captains who desperately wanted to get onto operations, but had been told that there was no bloody way they were going to make it because they were too valuable to the organizations here in Canada. And they created such a fuss that they finally were told, okay, they could go, but they would have to drop a rank. They'd have to go down to wing commander. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they both agreed immediately because this is what they really wanted. This meant they could be squadron commanders, not base commanders, squadron commanders, and actually get the operational experience as a squadron commander. And these two came over, and I met them, and Johnny Fouquet was a SASO at that time. He had just taken over as SASO. And he called me in, and he said, I want you to meet a couple of types, and here there was Carlin Kelly and Joe Stevens was their names. And I met them. They didn't mean anything to me, but Johnny had, Fouquet had known them in Canada before the war and knew them well, and they were great joking and laughing. Anyway, they went off and went through the heavy conversion unit, did their conversion training, and then did a few trips as second pilot. And then, this was before taking over squadron, this is when they were still gaining experience, and then they were allowed to go as their as captain. And I can remember that both their names came up on the board the same night as their first trip as captains. And, so, of course, the AOC, Black Mike, who knew both these people from pre-war days, they were both pre-war pilots. They weren't wartime people like myself. And by God, if both of them weren't shot down on that bloody raid. Their first time out as captains, and they both went for the chop. Well, poor old Black Mike, I thought he was just as white as a sheet when we finally packed it in, because it was obvious no point in sitting around any longer. They just weren't, they had bought it, and that was it. And it hit him very hard, because, again, it was the old business of there was a great deal of experienced pre-war people, and there weren't that many pre-war people, that hoping that they might have gained some experience who in the post-war period would have been able to go on with having had that operational experience and all the training experience in the world. And on their first trip as captains to buy it, terribly bad luck. That kind of thing happened. Another occasion I can remember, the weather was very heavy overcast. And there was really almost doubtful whether we should go or not. If the weather at the base really got bad, and the airfields were spread over enough of an area in the Vale of York that each base could have a little different condition. Mm-hmm. The elevation of each base was slightly different than you were in the Vale of York. so that local weather conditions could be quite different one from the next base down the line. So we always left the question of a cancellation of a raid up to the recommendation of the base commander. It was his job. If he felt the weather was suddenly getting so bad that there should be no more airplanes take off, the point being that if an airplane took off and ran into trouble, he wouldn't be able to get down again.
Yeah.
In a real emergency. If he lost an engine off to take off, and he had a whole full of, a load of bombs and a whole load of fuel, he had to get down quickly. And then really meant doing a circuit and coming around and landing immediately. And taking a chance on pranging and blowing up, but he shouldn't blow up, even if he pranged, because the bombs were not fueled or something like that. Theoretically, the risk was not that great.
Yeah.
And if a base commander felt that the conditions were bad enough, he would then phone group and say, our weather has deteriorated to the point where I'm recommending that we cancel takeoff. It would be discussed very quickly, right in the middle. I mean, they could have four or five airplanes. They could have airplanes actually running down the runway when this would take place. And then we'd say, okay, bingo, cancel. Well, this particular night, it was a daylight takeoff, late. It was it must have been sort of winterish, because I can remember it was a late afternoon. It must have been sort of 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was just beginning to, it was dusk. But it was terrible. Gee, it was drizzly, and there was low cloud, and it was one of those terrible Yorkshire, English Yorkshire days. Just frightful, cold, bitter. And it seemed that every airplane gone, and I had left to go over to the mess to have something to eat, dinner. That's right, it would be dinner. And all of a sudden, gee, we could hear the airplanes climbing over base. So they were trying to get up through this cloud. And all of a sudden, there was a most enormous whoomph. And she said, "What the hell was that? Somebody just dumped a load of bombs." Anyway, nothing I can do about it. And I kept on walking over to the mess, and then there was another enormous whoomph, which I could just hear. Jeez, what's going on? So, I better go back to the ops room. So I turned around to walk back to the ops room. And before I could get into the ops room, there were two more. And of course, by this time, I was running, and I got in the ops room, and I said, "What the hell's going on?" And of course, there was a just stunned silence in the ops room, because they couldn't answer the question. And they said, "We've got airplanes crashing all over the place." Well, within a matter of 10 or 15 minutes, I suppose we must have had 8 airplanes crash after they had to take off. And no reason. No call from them on their radios, nothing. Just all of a sudden there would just be a whoomph, and that would be it. Well, we couldn't do anything. The bombers were on their way, and of course there was great recovery going on, and there were a few people who survived these crashes, but they were not in very good shape, and most of the people were killed. And it wasn't until the first airplane came back that we could get some idea what the hell had happened. And then, of course, it was the old business. And again, it shows you how little we knew then of meteorology and the impact on flying. There was an inversion over the base. And as they climbed up, they went from this cold air and rain and then into warm air. And then they got all covered with moisture and then into the colder air. And, of course, started to ice up with the carburetors. Started to ice at an incredibly fast rate, faster than turning to what we called hot air, which pumped hot air so it could get rid of. And it was a freak meteorological condition, and it was pure ice that was causing these airplanes literally to fall out of the skies, all heavily loaded, needing, all riding very close, without too much airspeed to play around with, and any amount of icing, and of course we were stalling right away. And that's what it was. One and only occasion, I can remember that, and I can remember that. We were horrified, because it was almost as if, of course, sabotage was the first thing that went through our mind. Yeah. Sabotage. Somebody sabotaged the airplane. But again, there was nothing we could do. The airplanes had all taken off, and there was nothing we could do except sit there and pray that there wouldn't be any more, or that nothing would happen on the route. Oh, it was a dreadful night. Dreadful. Because again, we were in agony mentally until the first airplanes came back and they could tell us what had actually happened. And then we found out, of course, that they'd all had ice, but some of them have gone through perhaps a heavy queue and picked up more heavier icing than the others.
Yeah.
And we were just damn lucky that we had lost a heck of a lot of airplanes that night. Well, those were the sort of things that transpired. My job became pretty routine. I've described it exactly what I did, and with every raid, that was it. And when I had when there was no ops on, I would take this little car, and by this time I was now sort of dating Barbara, and so I would whip into Leeds and hope and pray that the police wouldn't catch me. And I had a run in with them one time. I used to get my half, and I talked about getting a half gallon coupon. I would use my car to go up and visit a base, and I would get a half gallon coupon. And there was a farmer down the road who liked Canadian cigarettes, and so I would go in with a carton of cigarettes, and for my half gallon coupon, he would fill my tank. Well, I don't know what the hell, a little more safe would take, but perhaps 4 gallons or something like that, and he'd give me 4 gallons of gas. Well, 4 gallons of gas, that car would run forever. So anyway, but of course, being on the road in a car, and one occasion I went to, I was lucky, it was an Observer Corps dance. They were having their annual dance, and so I went, not officially, but sure enough, my God, the next day a bloody Bobby didn't walk into my office and say, "Are you the owner of such and such a car?" And I said, "Yes." And were you at the, was your vehicle parked outside such and such a place in this hotel when this thing was? And I said, "Yes." And you right away quick. So I had to do some fast thinking. I said, "Well, what were you doing there?" Yeah. And I said, "I was there officially. I was representing the command at the Observer Corps dance." And so he said, "Oh, were you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, typical English Bobby, you know, real Yorkshire, broad Yorkshire accent, can we verify this? And I said, "Sure." I said, "Now look, I'm in the middle of planning an operation, but you go down to the camp commandant." And he is down, and I gave him a direction, the longest way I could think of to get him around to get down to the commandant's office. And I said, "You go there, and he will verify that I was there officially." Oh, God, as soon as Bobby got out of my office, I was on the phone to the camp commandant, and I said, "Just listen once, there's going to be time." I said, "There's a Bobby coming in." He was a squad leader. I said, "There's a Bobby coming, and you just tell him that I was the AOC's representative at the Observer Corps dance last night, and you make a quick entry in some bloody log where you gave me a 1 gallon coupon or something like that." And he just did it when the Bobby walked into the office. And he, sure enough, Bobby came back and said, "Thank you, sir. Thank you. Good day." And with that disappeared.
Oh, lovely.
I don't know what, I suppose I would have been, probably been a fine or something like that for being, because literally, there was no ration, there was no gas for anything. Barbara's father, he would let me have the odd coupon, but he had a business and had coupons. He was given coupons for his not only his own private, his own car, but the vehicles in the business and so forth. And it was all very tightly controlled. But all I needed was a half gallon coupon every once in a while, and this farmer friend down the road, and I would get my full tank of gas, which was enough to keep me going back and forth. But there was another incident where I, at Sixth Group, there were two other instances when I very nearly was fired. I was very nearly heaved out on my bloody ear. The first one was at the CEO's conference, and Black Mike McEwen, he died not so many years ago, bless his soul, was very conscious of the fact that he had not had any operational experience. He was a World War I fighter pilot, and all kinds of medals as a fighter pilot in World War I, but no World War II experience, although he did sneak out on a couple of raids. But he realized that he was not an operator in the true sense of the word, and therefore he had to rely on people like myself for advice, and really wasn't in any position to question too much. When I said this is the only way to do it, really he almost had to take it at face value. Well, the conference started, and the boy who ran the ops room was Chester Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And now lives in now retired, living just outside Trenton. And Chester and I were at the very end. So we sat right at the very end of the table because there was nothing really too much we could do. The agenda was all laid on, and a lot of it was training. There wasn't too much on ops because the ops, anything happened on ops, you were on top of it right away. You didn't wait for a conference. You got on top of it right away quick. And so there wasn't too much on operations. There was quite a bit on training, bombing practice, the sort of thing that would have a long-term effect on operations, but nothing really an immediate effect. And Chester was a great beer drinker. God, that man could chug-a-lug a pint of English bitter beer in something like about 2.1 seconds. Incredible. He literally had that ability to open his mouth and pour it down. And we had made, we used to go into Harrogate, which was the nearest town, mm-hmm. into Harrogate when there was a stand down, and as for a bit of a laugh, we'd get into a pub, and then I would get up to the bar and start chatting up some of the locals and talking about did they have any good beer drinkers and so forth, and how good were they, and after the kind of sucking them in a wee bit, then I'd say, oh, I've got somebody here who can drink pretty fast. Why don't we have a little contest for beers, for free drinks? Well, of course, Chester would be sitting in the back and sort of sitting at a table or the back of the room, and he might bring him in as a ringer, you see. Yeah. There was no way anybody could touch Chester. So, and I watched Chester one night at one pub drink 7 pints of beer, one right on top of the other, and I don't think his time changed more than about 0.4 of a second. Well, of course, we used to get an awful lot of free drinking out of this, and not that we needed the free drinking, it was just the sport of it. That was the fun. Well, at this conference, Chester and I at the end of the table, and it was very dull. The AOC was speaking, and it was on some training, and it was kind of boring. I leaned over to Chester and said, Chester, how about going into Harrogate tonight? Because this conference isn't going to go on until very... There's no ops on tonight. Why don't we go into Harrogate? And he sort of smiled and said, how about it? And I then started laughing. I said, I'll tell you what, we'll pull the old trick. And we were both smiling like crazy. Well, the conference finished. That was in the morning. And about noon, the call came for the AOC. He wanted to see me. And I walked into Black Mike's office, and he was in a rage. Absolute rage. And he immediately accused me of disloyalty, of laughing at his statements on operations or on the training impact on operations and so forth. I had made him look like an idiot. God, there I was standing with my mouth wide open. Because this had come out of nowhere. And that Hull was in the same boat, and he was going to see Hull as soon as I'd seen me. Well, he ranted. I couldn't get a word in edgewise. And it must have taken him 10 minutes to run down. He was so furious. This is why I say he was very sensitive about his lack of operation. Yeah. And this is what he was pouring out. He was just pouring it out. That he had not had the chances that I had had. And I had no right to laugh at when he was speaking to the squadron commanders and making him look silly and all this sort of thing. Oh, jeez. Because no one was looking at Chester and I. We were at the end of the table. He was at the other end.
Yeah.
They were all watching him. No one could see what we were doing. And God, when I finally explained to him what we'd said, he didn't believe it. Because he worked himself out. But anyway, I said, well, call in Chester and ask Chester what we talked. And I had no idea you felt like this or that we had upset you. And so God immediately called in Chester. And of course, fortunately, Chester's story jived with mine. Well, with that, he said, all right, go. No apology, like that. He just said, go. He was still steaming. I think he was now furious because he had taken off at the high port before, actually. But his parting gesture was, if that story had not jived, you both would have been off this out of the same quarters in nothing flat. And I just sort of shrugged. And by that time, I really didn't give a damn anyway. The next occasion, when I almost was fired, and this one really did make me mad, we had a new sasso came in to replace some Fouquet. And I had gone into Leeds. It was one of those nights when there was a stand down, no operations. It was in the wintertime. I went into Leeds, and it started to snow. So Barbara's father, then it was wet snow, that terrible wet snow, and driving bloody dangerous. So Barbara's father said, heck, instead of driving back tonight, why don't you stay overnight? And by morning, probably this will melt soon when it gets daylight, and at least there'll be a bit more traffic on the roads, and the trucks will soon get rid of the snow I had to get onto the main, how was that main highway called, the A1, which was running in north and south to get up to the headquarters. He said, the trucks will soon make mishmash of this, and so stay, and then it'll be a lot easier driving. So I said, okay, and stay. Well, I put my car in the driveway, and the driveway had a bit of a slope, and we had a dreadful time. But I couldn't get the car out of the damn driveway, and finally there was a service station down the corner, and damn near they didn't have a tow truck in there, and I got them to come and latch on and pull me out. And I suppose by now it's 8 o'clock or 8:30. And I still had a bit of a drive. Well, God, unbeknownst to me, I finally got on the road. About 2 minutes after I'd left, the phone rang, and it was Bill Warwick, who was a senior duty officer in the ops room, saying, "General, is good Captain Lane there?" "No. Where is he?" "He's just left. Oh, my God. There's just, you know, the daylight raid, and it's a panic. Just no time is going to be done in very, very short order," and so forth. So I was tootling along, quite happy, because I didn't expect anything. God, I got to the gate of at the park, and the service policeman on duty there said, "You're wanted in the ops room immediately, sir." So, oh, Jesus, something's up. Well, I drove up and I parked my car right in under the portico of the entrance, main entrance, because there was another SP there, and he said, "You're wanted in the ops room immediately, sir." So, of course, I immediately belted right into the ops room and walked in, and God, here's everybody, the AOC, the new SASO, all the op staff, the Met man, the Flak man, British Army major, everybody, armament people, the technical king, all standing around with their fingers literally up their backsides. And the AOC, just face as black as the ace of spades, said, "There's a daylight raid. We are briefing in 5 minutes. My job to go onto the phone in a brief in 5 minutes." And he didn't say another word because he realized that I had 5 minutes to figure out what the tactics were going to be on this bloody raid. So I just simply, of course, walked over to the board, saw what the target was, talked to the Met man, got the Met, and said, "What other groups are on?" And one of the forts in Chester had been on with other groups, and he found out what they were doing. It sounded good to me, the allocation of altitude had been given to us by Bomber Command, so no problem there. I talked to the Flak man, and in 5 minutes I turned to the OC and I said, "Okay, I'm ready. I'll brief." And he said, "But you haven't briefed me." And I said, You said, sir, I was to brief in 5 minutes. I'm ready to go." Normally we made notes and all kinds of things. Geez, I picked up a phone, went through the whole briefing, and when I finished, I said to the AOC, I said, "No, sir, have you any comments?" And he said, "No, I have nothing to add. Good trip, chaps." I put the phone down. God, he just glared at me, and he got up and he walked out of the ops room. And it took him about 48 hours before he said, "Where the hell were you?" And I said, "Geez, I was in Leeds. I got caught in that damn snowstorm." And by this time, we were on a pretty good basis. But he was still mad as hell at me. And he said, "Geez, another 5 minutes, and you would have been in deep trouble." And I said, "Well, I realize that." And I said, "But why the hell? Supposing I killed myself. What the hell were all the people doing in this ops room? That wasn't a difficult raid to plan. Sasso could have done it. Chester Hull could have. You could have done it. Why was everybody waiting for me? And why did you wait 5 minutes before any planning was done?" In other words, I got mad. And then he began to realize that they had literally, all those people were sitting waiting for me to turn up to plan an operation that could have been done by anyone. And it showed an abysmal ignorance or a lack of willingness to stick their necks out on the actual planning of a raid. Because if the raid went wrong, of course, and badly wrong, there was one person whose neck was out of mile, and that was in year one. Well, Jesus, I was mad. But as a result of that, my team off, nothing more was said other than the fact, "Where were you?" But he never took me to task, as he did the previous occasion, for disloyalty, as he called it. But those sort of things, as I say, that was sixth group. It was a routine staff job. No danger involved, but an awful lot of worry and concern. Because you, as I say, you were responsible for a raid, and if it went sour, the finger was pointed directly at you.
And of course, this sixth group, this was the all-Canadian squadron. Now, were the people at the headquarters, the planning staff, were they by this time all-Canadian?
They were all-Canadian, with the exception of Met, of course. And the Flak liaison officer was a British Army artilleryman, an ACAC man, a very fine person. But the rest of the staff were all English, all Canadian.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Except for that photo interpretation gal, the head of the photo interpretation section was also a WAF. She wasn't a WB, she was a WAF. Reason for that was that we had we hadn't trained people. We didn't have people experienced in that photo interpretation. It was still, even then, it was a very new art of photographs, and looking for bomb damage and being able to interpret and looking for such things as damage that might have been missed elsewhere. All that sort of thing. But the rest were all Canadians. Telecommunications staff were all Canadians. As a matter of fact, the head of the communications cell was Eaton. Which of the Eaton brothers? His first name, John Eaton. One of the Eaton brothers.
Yeah.
He used to get a check from Toronto every week. That was about six times his bloody pay as a wing commander, you know, from the Eaton family. But I guess that's it for Six Group, Reg.
Was there any talk at that time at group headquarters about the post-war RCIF?
No, none. No, the war, I was there, let's see now, I don't know the exact date. I was there for, I guess, about 9 months, which would have carried us through into 45, because it was that winter of 45 when several of these things happened, 44, 45. And then Tiger Force was formed down at Bushy Park. Tiger Force was formed when all of the SHAPE staff moved out of Bushy Park and went onto the continent. And Tiger Force headquarters was formed to plan the bomber offensive in the Pacific, to be the follow-on to VE Day in Europe.
Yeah.
I left, it would have been in the spring or early summer. Spring or early summer of 45 when I went to Tiger Force. And so that my time at Sixth Group was not really all that long. And I was, when I arrived down at Tiger Force headquarters at Bushy Park, I walked in and I was number three person on the staff. Air Marshal Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd was the commander in chief. He made his name in Malta. He commanded Malta, the AOC of Malta, during the great time when Malta was being blitzed every night and they were harboring bloody bombers.
Yeah.
Then there was the admin man was there, and then I came in as group captain ops, which was, again, the same kind of a job, Air One.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to be planning the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And within days, the staff grew very, very rapidly. And Sir Hugh Pugh Lloyd was living quite close to Bushy Park. He had his home there. And again, very kind to me in those first early days until we were working almost around the clock. He would invite me out for dinner to the home and stay overnight and so forth with Lady Lloyd and that kind of delightful person. Then, as the staff grew, which it did very rapidly, and they got into the details of planning the operation, operating out of Okinawa, which was to be the base. But we had to plan everything. The airfields, we were going to use Lincoln bombers instead of the Lancaster, because the Lincoln, by that time, had come into service, or was coming into service. It was just about the time of VE Day. And we needed the Lincoln to get the legs to get from Okinawa to Japan, sort of the same kind of thing as a B-29 type of approach line. And the detail planning was just going flat out. We had all the engineers had to be there, the technical people. We had to plan routes out. We had to plan the flying control. We had to plan the pathfinder procedure for target marking. Recoveries, what do we do, because if to meet the weather problem, because you're on an island now, it's a relatively small island.
Yeah.
There was nowhere to go. You had to get down.
Yeah.
And all the details had to be sorted out for that type of, for the war against Japan, the bomber war. And there were Canadians on the staff, because Canada was going to make a fairly big contribution to that. It was primarily British and Canadian, almost 50-50, with Australia throwing in one or two squadrons, as I recall. but it was primarily Canadian Britishism. And we got right down to where the advance party was divided into two sections. One was called Snowball 1 and the other was Snowball 2. And I was to head up Snowball 2. The advance parties were to leave. Snowball 1 was to leave 1 week ahead of Snowball 2 and get out to Okinawa, get on the ground out there, and get ready to start getting the airfields built and get ready for the bombers to come in. And the whole, by this time, all the logistics had been cranked up. We had a group captain who was admin plans, who was quite an incredible man. One of those fantastic Brits with a mind like a steel trap and a great planner. And he could write reams and it would just flow beautifully.
Yeah.
And it would all add up. And he was in charge of that. And he actually did all the dirty work. He had the real nasty job of all the logistics planning for that operation. And he did a superb job. His admin plan, when I read it, put together in no time at all, I didn't believe it. Yeah. I didn't think it was possible for someone to put a piece of paper together that quickly. And with that detail. And all of it accurate. Anyway, that was it. Well, we took off. At least Snowball 1 got away. And the day before, Snowball 2 was due to leave from Hendon in a transport airplane. The first atomic bomb was dropped. Yeah. And then there was a 24-hour delay. And I arrived down at Bushy Park headquarters with all my gear, all my tropical gear, everything ready to go. The bus was there. There were about 12 of us in Snowball 2. And we were just getting on the bus to go out to the airport when Osir Hugh came out and said, the war is over. They just dropped a bomb in Japan. And so he said, it's an indefinite delay. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said the war was over. An indefinite delay. It looks as if the Japs are going to surrender. So the Snowball 2 just stayed put. And we just cooled our heels for those few extra days or until it was obvious.
Yeah.
And Snowball 1 got out as far as India. And the commander-in-chief of India was Mountbatten.
Mm-hmm.
And he grabbed every one of those people and put them right on his staff up there. And they didn't get back to England. I understand, for about another year before he let them go. Yes. So I wondered what would have happened if I had gotten as far as India. I'm sorry. Snowball 1 got beyond India. They actually got into China. And then came back to India.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get to Okinawa. They got into Chungking or someplace.
Yeah.
And then they were recalled to India. And then Mountbatten grabbed them, and they were all on his staff. I'm sorry in one way that I didn't get up, because I'd like to have gone through India and perhaps gotten as far as Okinawa just to have had the experience of seeing it.
Yeah.
But
however, you've been away for many years.
Well, then even then I didn't come home, because by this time Barbara and I were engaged, and once VJD came along, there was no need to hold up a wedding.
Yeah.
And I went and saw the commander-in-chief overseas, RCF in London, and said, look, if you want people to stay here, anybody to stay here, I'm quite happy to stay now in any job you'd like to give me, because I want to get married and I would like to stay here for a while. So he said, well, it just so happens that that Ottawa's agreed to put together a transport force of Dakotas to help in the post-war period. And we want a base commander. We want two of them, in fact, because there's going to be two bases. Would you like one of the jobs? And, of course, I jumped on it. I said, oh, yeah, sure. And I'll talk about this perhaps a little bit more, because it was rather an interesting time.
Yeah.
But I wound up as the commander of that within a very short period of time, and I ran what was called 120 Wing. And we had some 75 Dakotas in that organization. But that's another story.
Yeah.
Another story. Yeah.
Yeah, we're just very close to being up. Well, that's beautiful.